find the answers to questions you may or may not have asked yourself here at Kaleidoscience, Conversations on Cognitive Science. This episode is hosted by Elisa Palmer and Sophie Kühner.
So today we will do another episode in our blog about sex and gender. And today we're here with Dr. Robert Paul Wiester, who is an assistant professor at the Department of Psychiatry and Addictology for the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Montreal. He's also the chairholder of the Sex and Gender Science Chairs and the director of the Research Laboratory on Sex, Gender, Allostasis.
Yep, that's right. Pleasure to be here.
And we are also talking to Mina Guerra, who is a PhD student on the topic of sex, gender, and cognition at the University of Montreal in Canada. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you so much to welcome us here. It's really a pleasure.
And as always, we play our short get-to-know game, where I will give you 5 sentence beginnings and would ask both of you, since we have 2 guests for this episode, to finish them. The first sentence is, as a kid, I always wanted to be.
I always wanted to be a scientist.
Oh.
Yeah, first it was a fireman. Then I saw a fire burn in my backyard and I decided I want to be a scientist.
That's an interesting shift from seeing fire and wanting to be a firefighter and then towards wanting to be a scientist. How is it for you now?
And for me, I think when I was a kid, I wanted to be a doctor. So it's not so much far away, but yeah.
Yeah. Our second sentence is, if I was an emoji, I would be.
I guess you could say I'd be like suspiciously, you know, one eyebrow up, kind of staring suspiciously.
Yeah. And for me, I think I would be the laughing and crying emoji.
Our third sentence. My favorite thing to do on a day off is?
Drink.
Drink. Nice.
And I think for me, it would be chilling at the park in the sun or go for a walk or a run.
Sounds also good. Next sentence. Right now, I'm most fascinated by?
I'd say epigenetics.
Epigenetics. Ooh. What is that? Can you explain?
Epigenetics is the study of how genes are turned on or off by the environment. So it's a way that our genes are kind of set in stone, but how they get turned on or off is really context specific, and it can be passed on from generations to generations. So I'm quite interested in seeing how it relates to marginalized populations, as well as populations that experience more mental health issues.
Yeah. And what's it for you, Mina?
I think for me right now is how AI can change how we work, the place it can take in education, but also research, and how it would change really our way to work. Yeah.
Yeah. I think right now there are so many different tools popping up all over the place.
Yeah.
It's just insane. And our last sentence. I know it's time to call it a day when?
When I'm falling asleep at the table.
I think that's the most classic researcher answer.
For me, I think it's when I read the same sentence all over again and I repeat and I just don't comprehend anything of it.
Yeah. Okay, thank you so much. Before we start into our topic, can both of you shortly tell us where you started in your scientific path and how you got in the position you're working in? And we start with you, Rob, and then go into you, Mina.
I was very fortunate that quite early on, I discovered a passion for diagnosing people. I was finishing high school. The internet was pretty new. And I had a particular friend who had very strange personalities. Like she would say like, oh, I'm going for lunch with my associates. And she pretended that she was a singer. And basically she was classic narcissist. And I had great delight in diagnosing her and then diagnosing a whole bunch of other people. And I thought, you know what? I could do this for a living. So I gave up the idea of going in theater, which I had been doing and was pretty committed to having a career in acting. But I went into liberal arts to learn a lot about history, philosophy, and psychology. And then I did a bachelor's in psychology with the hope of becoming a psychologist, and then went into neuroscience. At the time, neuroscience was sort of an offshoot of psychology, and just continued on in that direction until the end of my PhD. Then did a postdoc at Columbia University in public health as well as psychiatry. And then was really happy to be recruited back in my hometown in Montreal by the University of Montreal, by the Faculty of Medicine, the Department of Psychiatry, largely because of work that I was doing with the LGBTQ plus community, which was really, I think, a big full circle. As a gay man, I spent a lot of time thinking about my sexuality and getting into research in that area. And so to then be brought back to be a professor to continue that work was really very, very much of an honor and a humbling experience.
Yeah.
And now I get the good opportunity of mentoring brilliant students like Mina, who continue on this research program.
Sounds like a really good path, actually, and quite straightforward, at least from the parts you told us now.
Yeah, I have to say, I'm fortunate that I had a sense of where I wanted to go, and I never really imagined myself not finishing university. I'm fortunate that I wasn't conflicted with a lot of choices. That being said, I still think one day I'm going to go back to school to get a clinical psychology training, because that's something that I wanted. It's something that I still wanted to get paid for diagnosing people.
And assume you're not doing that at all at the moment.
Well, not getting paid, but definitely judging people.
And how's it for you, Mina? Where did you start and what are you doing right now?
Yes, well, I started in my bachelor's in cognitive neuroscience and had the chance to work in different laboratory with different subjects like EEG, so brain imaging, and more social neuroscience. And I had great opportunities, but then at the end of my bachelor degrees, I had the chance to do a honor thesis, and that's where I saw you can choose a project you want to work on, and I saw the list of projects, and I saw the project Robert Paul was working on, and it was at this moment, I think, like the light bulb moment, just the light bulb turned on. I was like, oh my god, I really want to work on this project about sex and gender stereotypes, cognition. So that's where I started. And then after my bachelor's degree, I went to the PhD in neuropsychology, where I'm training I do research, and I'm doing a clinical course also. So I'll be a neuropsychologist at the end of my PhD. I'm continuing the same project at the bachelor, but I want to put more the things I learned in my bachelor's degree in this project, so brain imaging, and that's where I am right now.
Thank you. Okay, so jumping right in, since you already mentioned cognition, Gina, we're just going to jump right into our whole topic. Before, can one of you explain us what is sex, what is gender, and what's the difference between both?
So maybe I can take a stab, and maybe Mina, you can compliment me for gender stereotypes. So sex is really everything that's biological. So genes, chromosomes, anatomy, hormones. And it's really, when we're thinking about sex, we're often thinking about birth assigned sex. So whether someone is male or female on a certificate. But that's not enough. There's a lot of variation within. Some people are born intersex, so with genitals that are not clearly male or female, and during adolescence it can change. Our levels of gonadal hormones or sex hormones are also very different. So some women can have levels of testosterone that are as high as men. This obviously is something very problematic in the Olympics, because it's used as a criteria from which to define what's male or female. But then we also know there's differences in muscle mass and in the functioning of organs and the functioning of cells. Then on the flip side of that, there's sociocultural gender, which is really all the sociological, psychological, cultural aspects that envelop an individual. And so this is usually classified in four different domains. So gender identity is really what's most close to the person in terms of whether they feel that they are transgender or cisgender, which the majority of the population is, whether birth assigned sex aligns with their gender identity. They can be non-binary, they can be androgen. There's a lot of different, you know, terms that can be used to define that. Then at a level a little bit more surrounding the person is gender roles. So how masculine or feminine people are, how androgynous they are. So how high levels of masculinity and femininity are considered androgynous. And in the psychology literature on gender roles, it's considered something adaptive. Then at a level even more meso level is gender relations. So what are the stereotypes or expectations of how men, women, and gender diverse people should behave? What is the expectation in a workplace environment or in a university environment? What's the proportion of men and women within different university departments? And then at the most macro level, you have what's called institutionalized gender, which are really the systems of power that dictate expectations and laws regarding males, females, and gender diverse people. So you can imagine representation of women in politics, or the gender pay gap, or living in a United States where there's abortion bans. Those kinds of things will influence the individual. And so we're very interested in studying these things. And Mina is very interested in studying gender stereotypes that are kind of embedded within all of those different dimensions.
Yeah, so how gender stereotypes, you know, you can be in the workplace, you know, when like almost in the most of the time in STEMs, so science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. So in STEM domains, there are studies have shown that there's much more gender stereotypes, and that can impact a lot of things. It can impact how you perceive yourself and how you will your performance at work, and yeah, so you can have an impact on a lot of things.
Yeah. Since you, Mina, also said that you're especially fascinated by cognition, mm-hmm. Can you maybe tell us also how hormones have an influence on cognitive abilities, cognitive changes, yes. And how that can influence the perception and reality of a person as well?
Yes, so hormones, sexual hormones can have an influence on cognition. So studies have shown, so testosterone can, for example, have an impact on visuospatial skills. So how people can navigate a space, manipulate 3D objects in their head, things like that. And these abilities have shown that men are better in visuospatial tasks. So that can be explained by the level of testosterone. But on the other side, progesterone and estrogen can also be linked to cognition, so to verbal skills. So women have been shown to be better at verbal skills, but also fine motor skills. So that can be linked to hormonal levels, but it's really not that simple. Hormone can be linked to a lot of other things. It can be linked to the level of femininity and masculinity people feel. It can be linked also to, it can change as a function of your sexual orientation. So someone who is let's take a gay man, their level of sexual hormones can be different, and that can impact the cognitive performance. But everything is really linked. So we have biological factors, but also gender factors, and they link together and they inter-influence cognition. So it's a really complicated subject to study, because you have to take very different factors, and all of those factors influence themselves also. So yeah, I don't know if you, Rob, you want to...
Yeah, no, that's so important. And, you know, there is this sort of artificial distinction of like, what is biology versus what is sociology, and hormones are a wonderful interface of how that's very dynamic. So we know, for instance, that testosterone is going to be higher in women that are stressed. And so when we see, for instance, in our studies that lesbian and bisexual women have higher levels of testosterone, is that is that explaining why they're lesbians, or is it more an artifact of stigma that they're experiencing? Another really good example is we think about testosterone in the context of aggression. Yes, there is an association with high levels of testosterone and being aggressive, but you also see studies where aggression, it comes before higher levels of testosterone and can then be influenced by stress that either shuts the axis or amplifies it. So it's constantly, everything is intertwined. And more we're talking about sex and gender entanglement. So kind of like in particle physics, how sex and gender are not these separate constructs, but these sort of like mutually reinforcing phenomena.
So when you do research on this, and all these factors are so highly intertwined, how do you like try to set them apart a little bit?
Well, I think a great way to study these different factors is by including gender diverse people, actually. So by including gender diverse people, so trans, gender and non-binary, you can explore more these factors, because if you take, for example, a transgender person, you can see the impact of hormone treatment and the impact of how your biological sex is different from your gender identity. So you can, when you compare those group with cisgender people, so people who have their gender identity is compatible with their birth assigned sex, when you compare those group, you can see difference, and you can see how gender identity can change cognitive performance, but in this example, cognitive performance, but also a lot of other variables. So by including this diversity, it's really a great way to explore these factors.
I would add as well that it's really important to be able to look at different developmental or life stages. So when people, when women start menarche, when boys start puberty, when women have their first babies, number of babies, when they have menopause, these are all very important developmental milestones that are very important to study and understand how hormones fluctuate and how that relates to cognition. In order to do that, though, you need large samples. And so that's, I think, the strategy that my lab has really employed, is trying to recruit as much as we possibly can. And in order to do that, we need to work very closely with the community that we're engaged with. So that means including people from the community in our lab, so that it's research being done by the community for the community. And also just being attentive to what are the concerns or the health needs expressed by marginalized communities.
Yeah. One thing I never thought about before, Amina, you just mentioned different hormonal states as well. In, I think you mentioned trans people. Are you aware of any researcher, one of you, that also has looked into and how far the hormones of a trans man is different from a cis woman? So before transitioning or before taking hormonal replacement therapy?
That's a great question. We have some unpublished data that's part of Mina's thesis that's focusing on non-binary participants, many of which are not taking hormones. And maybe, Mina, you could talk about the hormone profiles and also the cognitive results.
Yes, so in our study, we managed to recruit 123 non-binary people. And so we could look more in their cognition and hormonal levels. And what we have found is that non-binary people have level of testosterone between those of men and women, and also more estrogen and more progesterone than men. But we have to take account that in our sample, 80% of the non-binary person were assigned female at birth, so that can influence. But also, you can see that the testosterone level was in between those of men and women. But what is really interesting is in cognition, we have found that for let's say, feminine tasks, so tasks where we think we expect women to perform better. So verbal tasks and fine motor skill tasks. We have found that non-binary people were better than men, but also better than women in some of the tasks, and like verbal memory. And we actually found no difference between men and women, but we found that non-binary were better than men and women. So that was quite interesting. And if we look at the masculine tasks, so visual spatial tasks where we expect men to be better, we have found that non-binary people were also better than women. So this is quite interesting, because if we have looked just at the sex assigned at birth, like I said, 80% of them were assigned female at birth. If we just take the sex assigned at birth, we miss a lot of information. It doesn't explain why they are better than women in visual spatial tasks. It's a quite interesting phenomenon. We have, I think we expect them to perform in between men and women. So this is quite interesting that they are actually better than both sometimes.
Yeah, that's true. Since you mentioned that 80% were assigned female at birth, I would assume that they are individuals that have a menstrual cycle. And how far did you take those hormonal changes? Because there are quite large monthly fluctuations, depending on the cycle phase a person is in, into account.
Well, we took all of these data, but I didn't have the time yet to really explore them. But it can have an impact on as an individual stake. But since we look at means across a really large samples, it's unrelated a bit. So in the group of women, we didn't separate from the menstrual cycle. But yes, it can impact cognition.
Yeah. Earlier, we also touched upon the impact of stress on gender different, or people with different gender identities to those assigned at birth. Can you maybe tell us a bit more on what is known about the influence stress can have on those individuals?
That's a very broad question. I think it really depends on a lot of, like, if you're asking the question from a developmental perspective, I think that's sort of beyond the scope of this podcast, in the sense that there's so much research showing like how family dynamics are hugely important in protecting or producing stress among LGBTQ plus youth and then emerging adults. I think in the context of the work that we do, so we're very interested in emerging adulthood, and all of our work is done primarily, well, exclusively with adults. We're getting at some experiences that people have had over the course of their life in relation to their current levels of stress. And so we can stress people out in laboratory tests that were mostly designed in Germany. So the Triage Social Stress Test is a classic task that we use, as well as many people in the world, in order to stress people and to see the production of the stress hormone cortisol. We can also look at chronic stress. So by taking a blood draw, we can look at not just cortisol, but we can look at insulin levels. We can look at inflammation. We can look at lipid levels, triglycerides. All of these biomarkers are correlated with cortisol. And we're very interested in studying what's called allostatic load. So the wear and tear on the body and on the brain of chronic stress, and seeing how that relates to different populations that we study. Our general hypothesis when starting this work during my PhD was that LGBTQ plus people are going to have higher allostatic load and higher levels of cortisol. But what we're finding is it's very dependent on what subgroup you're looking at. So if you're looking at transgender and non-binary people, so far the results that are emerging show that they are the ones that have the highest allostatic load. But then for some reason, gay men seem to be the ones with the lowest. And that could potentially be explained by the appropriation of different health-related behaviors. So there is research in psychology showing that they tend to be in better shape than heterosexual men. They tend to pay more attention to their diet. So that could be influencing their lipid profiles. they could also be experiencing some sort of resilience, having gone through the process of self-identification and then coming out. That's something that builds what's called hardiness. So that could also be explaining that result. We don't see the same parallel in lesbian women, except that despite sometimes being a little bit heavier, so a little bit of a higher body mass index, what we're seeing in our research and in our colleagues' research is that they seem to have very healthy lipid profiles despite being heavier. So all very interesting differences that I think are explained by very unique subgroup differences within each letter of the LGBTQ plus alphabet. So maybe I could add to that that something specific to Mina's work was that in doing these cognitive tasks, doing cognitive tasks can be stressful. You know, we know that for research, especially with older adults, that if you put them in conditions that are unfavorable to their age, they're going to perform worse. So this is some really cool work done by my colleague, Shireen Sindhi at Karolinska Institute that she did during her PhD with our common mentor, Sonia Lupien. She basically put older adults in situations where they either had to do testing with someone who was the same age as their granddaughter or grandson, tasks that were very kind of test-based, university style, in an environment that was new, and at a time of the day in the afternoon, which is not their best chronotype, versus doing it in a situation where they're being tested by someone their age, they're being tested in an environment that they've been to before, they're being tested in the morning, which is their better chronotype. And what we found was that if you put them in situations that are more stressful, their cognitive abilities are going to be impaired. So we were kind of inspired by that work in looking at cognitive abilities where there's differences between men and women. And so we decided to add a gender stereotype to our protocol in order to see if that would stress people out. And so I'll maybe let Mina talk about what that gender stereotype was.
Yes, so before each task, we told participants, so for the next task, you're going to do this, blah, blah, blah. But just so you know, women are better at this task. Actually, research has shown that women are better. And we did, we alternate between men and women. And so we expect to see an impact on performance as recent studies have shown. So it's called the stereotype threat theory. So when it's the fear of confirming a stereotype about your group. So if I thought a woman that for a mathematical a math task, men are better, the fear of confirming that stereotype will impact negatively the performance. So we expect to find those effects in our study. But surprisingly, we did in fact find an impact of gender stereotyping on our performance, and that could be explained by a lot of things. Firstly, in our sample, like we said, we have a very diverse sample. So 66% of our sample were people from the community, the LGBTQ plus community. So maybe just by being a part of the community, you have a different vision of gender stereotype. You're already non-conforming of the heterosexual gender norm stereotype, so maybe it's just not that impactful. Also, we are all young women from 20 to 25 years old who are administering the task, so that could be an impact. Also, maybe we're not that convincing also, or we were too explicit also. So in our testing, so people were maybe suspectful of of the things we did, and so that is our hypothesis. But we want to go in our future research more. We want to research more internalized stereotypes. So instead of putting a threat on people and experimental manipulation, we want to just measure internalized stereotypes of people. So by questionnaires, but also implicitly by using the implicit association test. So this is a test that was used at the beginning to study racial stereotypes. And basically, you have to categorize people and it measures your response time. And by measuring this response time, you can actually measure if the person has a bias. So a gender bias or racial bias. So we want to measure that and see if it will impact cognition. And we want to include people from diversity and especially gender diverse people, because in our hypothesis, we think that, for example, non-binary people who doesn't really fit with one gender description will have less gender expectations about their performance than those of other people. So that's really our research questions for our next project. Yeah.
I think it's really cool because when you mentioned the stress of like fulfilling a gender stereotype, I was also thinking whether there are people who just don't care about it, whether they fulfill said stereotype or not, and that just think, yeah, whatever.
Actually, when we test people at the end, we always ask people, how did you notice when we said those things? Did you think it affected your performance? And at the beginning, we thought that gender diverse people would be more stressed because, you know, we always said men are better or women are better. And so we thought they will feel excluded and they're never, well, the group that performs the best. But it was quite the contrary. We observed, actually, when we talked to non-binary person at the end, they were like, oh, well, I didn't really care. It didn't apply to me. So they were the least stressed about disinformation. And but for most of people, they don't really care about this. Yeah.
My intuition, when hearing that, my first intuition would just be, well, they have to kind of dissociate from gender norms to a certain degree anyways, because they were socialized with a gender norm that never fitted them and then had to dissociate from that anyways.
They already did the work of thinking about, oh, their genders, their role, gender stereotype, it doesn't necessarily is true because it doesn't apply to me. So we actually also, all participants take a questionnaire about their beliefs about cognitive performance of men and women. And in this questionnaire, people were asked to, for different abilities like it was drawing, but also doing math and different things like that. Do you think men or women are better at this task? And non-binary and gender diverse people in general were the least had the least beliefs about the performance of men and women. They think that there were no difference between men and women. So yeah,
interesting.
If I can add to the discussion about stress, I think if someone grows up and is able to, you know, thrive and be themselves and be gender non-binary or gender non-conforming, which not exactly the same thing, but gender non-conforming, if they're not experiencing stress or being told that they shouldn't be behaving that way, that is probably like the healthiest possible profile. But that's not necessarily what we're seeing in some of the work that we're doing. And I think that might be very specific to the context where we're studying this. So Montreal is a very liberal city. I think if we were to do this kind of work in, more repressive societies, it would be a different story. So I think that's an important consideration, that where you live, where you grow up, are very important factors in determining how gender nonconformity is going to be accepted or punished.
Yeah, definitely. I would also assume that at the moment, people who were in certain areas of the world, wherever that is, might feel an increased level of stress just because politics or societal changes that cause more difficulties for them in their day-to-day lives.
Absolutely.
Maybe coming back to more general, is there a difference in things that stress people or how they perceive stress among genders? So not only non-binary people, but also assigned at birth male, assigned at birth female, etc.
My mentor, Sonia Lupien, likes to use the acronym NUTS. So novelty, unpredictability, threat to the ego, sense of control. So NUTS. In French, we use spin, so sense of control, personnalité menacée, imprévisibilité, et nouveauté. I think all of those things converge on control to a certain extent. So something that's unpredictable, you didn't really have complete control over it. Something that's new, you have not had the time to contextualize it. Your ego, your sense of self being threatened, that's also a loss of control because someone is putting you in question of yourself. So I think stress at its core is really about how much you feel in control of the situation. And there's a lot of research in psychology by Lazarus and Folkman, for instance, that looks at stress as this transaction between what is the threat in the environment and what is my capacity to deal with it and cope with it. So I think based on that basic knowledge of control, there's going to be different people that have less control over certain aspects of their lives. So being gay or being transgender is not really something you can control. You can control, you know, how much you engage in behavior or the expressions, but at its core, it's not something that's a choice. So that right off the bat creates this inner conflict that is then, you know, related to developmental processes like self-acceptance and the coming out process. You know, something really interesting to this day, any person that's a sexual minority will usually have spent 5 years thinking about it before they ever engage in any kind of behavior, and then 5 years more before they start actually telling their family. So there's a whole period of time that people are processing this sort of uncontrollable secret. Unless, of course, they, you know, have parents that just, you know, tell them, hey, what's up? And, you know, that they're, you know, there's an openness. But I think even today, there's that stress that still exists for the community, especially for transgender and non-binary people that are experiencing a lot of hatred around the world. I think it's a similar kind of process for a lot of different groups. I think any kind of ism, whether it's, you know, sexism, racism, ageism, homophobia, transphobia, I think they leave like a similar kind of biological scar on the individual. But I think each group is going to have its own kind of unique mix of risk factors and protective factors that's going to make the ultimate profile a little bit different. So I'll give you an example. Hispanics in the United States that are first generation do not appropriate the same kinds of diseases as other minority groups that come to the U.S. in terms of cardiovascular disease and metabolic disease. And despite the fact that their diet does adapt a little bit to the American model, they are very close to their families and have a very tight social network that protects them from some of the discrimination that other groups might experience. So it's come something called the Hispanic paradox, that despite being a minority group experiencing a lot of discrimination, they have a very tight-knit family network that kind of protects them. Then on the flip side, you know, Black African-American men who are gay or bisexual are 30 times less likely to come out to their family. So, you know, there's differences in which groups you appropriate, and also the intersection of being, you know, a Black lesbian woman is multiple different identities that are potentially marginalized. So it's a very rich and very complex research space, because one glove does not fit all, one size does not fit all. And our goal is to really try to better understand, you know, one piece at a time, one glove at a time, what is the unique experience of these different groups.
I think that's really cool, especially because, yeah, different groups have different, like, with a Black lesbian, for example, there are many, like, marginalized problems, like, intersecting. So I think it's really cool to also, like, look at the singular facets in this and not just at how the person being lesbian influences their life, but rather how the combination of it all.
Mm-hmm.
And when you just mentioned that people basically spend about 10 years before coming out to their family, I found that very interesting because that seems quite long, actually. And I wonder how in that time, them not being able to, for example, express themselves fully, like, adds to the stress they experience.
Absolutely. And just, you know, the first next intersection that I can add to that is whether someone lives in a city or in the country. That's going to have a huge influence on just that reality of what it's like to be a, you know, a sexual or a gender minority in a space where you know, there aren't many like you. Cities self-select, so it's not surprising that, this, you know, on average in Canada, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people represent anywhere from like 3 to 4% of the population. But if you look at cities, it's usually anywhere from 10 to 20%. And that's because people are leaving, you know, the rural areas in order to be together in the cities. That being said, I don't want to make it sound like people from the country are less liberal or more conservative. Or in Quebec, for instance, we've seen in the last few decades a real change in a lot of rural spaces actually being much more open. Of course, there's some spaces that are not, and that will always be the case in certain spaces, but there is change but you know, that reality does have a huge influence on the experience. And you can imagine that in other contexts. So the moment that you go to university, that increases the likelihood for a woman to have a same-sex experience by like multiple times. So that, you know, based on your social economics of whether you have the opportunity to go to university or not, is also going to have an influence on the likelihood that you will actually have same-sex, you know, experiences.
I would also just, for the numbers that are more people, there are more people who are not fitting the expected norm. It's just like, I would assume it also feels easier to hide, especially when you're not certain of what you are experiencing. I mean, I think, or at least from what I got from previous conversations we had, was that, of course, it's changing quite a lot due to social media as well, so that people are easier on or in communities digitally at first, or see other life realities they can then adapt to, or maybe also figure out, well, that's also what I am feeling, what I'm experiencing. It might also apply to me. But I would assume that before social media got that impact on communities, it was just easier to go to larger places or larger cities because it offers you more anonymity. I struggle with that word. to start with. And by that automatically also acts more like a magnet for people who notice that they're different to what society might expect from them.
Absolutely. I think, you know, the social media and the internet and a lot of these dating apps have completely changed the ecosystem, not just for the queer community, but also for heterosexuals. And I did my postdoc at Columbia University in New York City. So I spent quite a bit of time, you know, in Greenwich Village, where one of the greatest historical villages in the world is. And it was interesting to see at what point people would be at bars, but on their apps while they were at the bars. And so I think that's an interesting kind of phenomenon that speaks to that reality. That being said, I think these apps have also had a negative effect on the community, because people are not going out as much. People are not patrons as much. People don't have the need to go to the bar and flirt and meet. So that's, I think, unfortunately, impacted a lot of cities, gay villages around the world. Many have closed down in, I think, direct relation to the 2008 recession, but I think also in direct relation to apps like Grindr and Scruff. And I don't know if there's a lesbian app, but there, you know, must be one.
It's not aware of any specific. I know that at least locally in Osnabrück, people are using one specific app, but it's not explicitly for gay communities or lesbian communities. Just one app that seems to work quite well in some cities around Germany.
Interesting. So actually, Grindr was the first app ever to use that GPS, and it became one of the most profitable applications in the early days of smartphones. I think the model has just been expanded and refined by all its successors.
Rob, you just mentioned that those apps who allow more being seen or easier access has some downsides. Is that the similar effect for general diversity? Can it also have a negative effect on individuals or on health, or is it just all positive?
I think in like everything, you know, it's a mix, right? You know, I've spoken to a lot of my friends about this when, you know, we were young teenagers getting off at Beaudry Metro Station, which is the gay station in Montreal, and feeling this sense of you know, excitement and shame and embarrassment. And the older we get and the more mainstream things become, that goes away. So I think there's a lot of people who kind of feel that being out in the open has kind of, yes, it's been related to social progress and civil rights, but it has also changed the very nature of what it means to be, you know, different and queer. And I think some groups have benefited a lot more than others. So gay men, by virtue of being men, have had a much easier time than any other group. But, you know, lesbian women, bisexual women, are still experiencing big gender pay gaps. I think there's a lot of issues of sexism that are embedded within sexual minority women that are not fully addressed in the current context and have to be really kind of better understood. Bisexual women and bisexual men, especially when it comes to sexual orientation, are the groups that experience still to this day, despite, you know, greater openness and greater societal acceptance, they're still the groups that experience the worst mental health. So I think, once again, you know, one size doesn't fit for all. It's each group is appropriating it in different ways. And I think now, with everything that's happening with the transgender and non-binary community, there's divisions, I think, within the LGBTQ+ community of whether people are going to stand in support or whether they're going to keep their distance because they don't want to necessarily lose their privilege. How are things in Germany these days?
Somewhat complicated in some regards. I think still better compared to other places, but well, right now I feel like it's a bit uncertain because we have a shift in our politics as well at the moment. So it's a bit difficult right now to predict how it's going to change for the next 4 years or in the next 4 years. I think over the past 5 to 10 years, it has been improving quite a lot. And right now it's just about to wait how it's shifting again, because at least in, I might also be in quite a bubble, social bubble, because at least the study program I'm in and where Sophie also started off at, it's really open to transgender bisexuality, all individuals. And I am quite in that bubble at the moment. So for me, it's super clear that people do face difficulties, but at least in the with the people surrounding them, it's easier compared to normal society or the rest of society. Mm-hmm. I feel like at least in larger cities and towns or with younger people, there is quite a lot of openness and quite a lot of acceptance. I feel like as you described earlier as well, in smaller places or villages, it's still more conservative. Yes, Sophie, would you add anything on that?
So I don't live in Germany currently. So my perspective on this might be like a little bit different. But I would say generally Germany is progressing quite a lot. A law was also released last year, I think, to make it easier, for example, for trans people to have the gender they identify with in their documents.
It could also quite easy to change names actually for all people. So not even transgender people, but just for anyone to just change their name by, like, it just got easier compared to how it was before.
But on the other hand, as Elisa said, we had elections like 3 or 4 months ago, and the government has just formed, like, and been finalized last month. And compared to the previous government, the government is a lot more conservative. So I'm also interested how this is going to be, like, how this is going to develop, and whether or not, like, LGBTQ plus rights are going to be affected by the new government.
But overall, I feel like, at least in cities, the communities are quite strong. So, like, I feel like at least communities are still tied together and support each other.
Mm-hmm. I think that's important. And it, in Canada, we just had an election that brought back a Liberal government, but we were quite afraid of what a Conservative government would mean, and kind of a repetition of Trump, you know, things like intersectionality, gender, equity, diversity, inclusion were all sort of terms that the Conservatives had took issue with, and they had started going into grants, funding trans research, and identifying what they thought was you know, research that shouldn't exist. So we're optimistic, but you know, what's happening in the U.S. affects us. And that being said, you know, there's something called community crisis competence. So the LGBTQ plus community is very resilient and has shown throughout history an incredible ability to mobilize in the face of things like the HIV/AIDS pandemic, and now in response to a lot of right wing conservative politics. So I think it's important for us to be very careful and to continue doing this kind of research. But I think it's important for the community to, you know, to stand strong and to resist.
And also, like, I am currently in mental health research, and I know that it's getting, like, my supervisor of my current project is currently doing her PhD, and she just said that it's so hard for her to get governmental funding for projects. So she now tries to get funding from companies, because she said, well, from the governmental side right now, it's not looking like there are going to be any female health related grants in the near future.
Really?
Yeah.
That's really unfortunate, because Germany is doing some really good work in the sex and gender space. And so that's a real shame.
Yeah. I mean, it's not impossible, but it's just getting harder to get any grants at all.
Yeah.
This is also why it's hard to make any predictions, because the government has just formed and we are now waiting how it will impact grants, fundings, etc.
Let's stay optimistic.
Yes. Of course.
It's scary, I think, how politics can influence research. And it's not supposed to be that way, I think. And when I started my PhD, I was really optimistic. I just wanted to study sex and gender differences, gender diverse people, and to see how things are going in the United States. It scares me sometimes to see how, but I think in Canada we're pretty much okay right now, so that's comforting. But we wanted to go to a conference this summer in the United States on sex and gender, and we chose to didn't go because we didn't feel safe going across the border with our posters non-binary cognition. That's kind of sad, I think, to see how politics can interfere with research.
I think it, especially the US, is quite scary at the moment, just mm-hmm. how fast it's changing and how drastically it's changing. Maybe coming back to your research for some last questions before we finish up. You've mentioned a bit earlier that Montreal is quite gender diverse and gender open. So from that, and you also mentioned your numbers you had in your study, mm-hmm. Mina, so that's quite large numbers. would you still say it's like, how do you actually recruit people for mm-hmm. gender diverse studies, first of all? And second of all, would you say it's more difficult compared to gender traditional studies?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. And that is a question I get a lot. So people are impressed sometimes by our numbers, but it really wasn't that hard. We put a lot of work. I don't want to give that impression. We worked really hard to get these numbers, but the main strategy was just to be a safe space for these people. And I think we have, like Robert Paul just said before, we have a great link with the community. So we did recruitment. We focus on these groups. We did posters just for these groups, and we told them, this is a safe place, you can come, we want to study you, we want to include you in studies. And gender diverse and especially non-binary people were like, yes, we want to come, we want to be included in studies. And when people arrive at the lab, we always introduce ourselves, like, hi, I'm Mina, I use she, her pronouns, what's yours? And we assure that we have bathrooms for everybody. So just this link, and just to have a nice link with community, we, at the end of each testing, people were often like, oh my God, I really enjoyed this experience, I will talk to my friends about it. So that's how we really achieved this recruitment, because people were talking to their communities also, and that's how we brought a lot of people. And actually, our non-binary group were not the last one to be filled. It was much more harder sometimes to recruit men in our studies. So yeah, it really, I think these are quite simple strategies that everybody can include in their research. You just have to do it. And sometimes I think people are afraid to do things wrong. They're afraid that they're gonna get offend some people, but you just have to be open-minded that you can make mistakes. It's not that important. If you just correct yourself, it would be okay. And I think to consult people of the gender diversity before, it's a really great way to do that. So to just ask people, how we could include you, how you would feel if we do that. So yeah,
I think that's super well said. The one thing I would add too is being able to consult with the community was something that we realized quite early on needed to go a little bit further than, you know, just reaching out periodically, but really making it really pretty much cross-sectional and cross-cutting, in the sense that they would be part of the project throughout. And so we recruited into our lab, you know, students that were from the community. We created also some funding mechanisms that would recruit people representing diversity, and that I think was a really smart thing to do, and I think can be done in any context of any population that's marginalized, is being sure to be attentive to, you know, what are their research interests, to work in partnership.
Yeah, so kind of do research with the people you want to include, mm-hmm. and not only on the people you want to include. I think we already had that in one of our earlier conversations with one new professor at our university, Jen Eikers, who also said, well, it's about especially trans people doing research on their transness, and not people not being trans doing research mm-hmm. about trans people.
One more question that kind of ties into this. So I have a background in emotion research, and emotion perception, at least from what we know, is different between the genders. And we had one instance in the past where we had male and female groups, but we were unfortunately unable to reach enough people who like identify as trans to open a third group for like statistical mm-hmm. significance. And I firstly wonder, like, if you have any propositions, just so how to approach the Nina just mentioned, but also like how to probe a little bit in research.
Yeah, so I have three suggestions. So, you know, for studies that are already done, you know, with a small proportion, you know, unanalyzable, you can still describe it. And I still would encourage in publications that even if you don't do any, you know, statistical testing, that you at least present the data descriptively so that someone else could potentially use that data in their own research. Related to that, I think it's important to think about consortiums where data could potentially be pooled in order to allow small studies to combine and to grow. And thirdly, this is more at the level of grants and recruitment. Recruiting participants is not a passive process. And I think a lot of people just sort of assume that, like, well, you know, we're going to get what we get, and that's just that. But I think there's actual strategies, like Nina mentioned, that, you know, you can engage in to over-amplify or over-represent certain groups that you want to include more of. So, you know, it's not a bad thing to say, okay, we want to represent more people of a particular group, so we're going to engage with community organizations in order to make that happen. And sometimes it will work, sometimes it won't. You know, there's certain groups that, you know, for very good reasons, don't want to participate in research. Mm-hmm. Trans women have a bit of research fatigue. A lot of the research that's been done among them is very focused on HIV/AIDS and gender transition, but what they would like is stuff on, you know, gender euphoria rather than gender dysphoria or positive sexuality or, you know, resilience. So that's a community that I can understand. They are a little bit fatigued, and I think activities and efforts need to be put in place in order to correct that if they are to be included in the future. So if there's a resistance from a community, you have to respect that. But you also, I think if you want to do good research, find ways of working with them to have them feeling engaged.
Yes, I think it's important because some people might say, oh, you're introducing a bias by inviting really specific groups. But I think there's already a bias. I think these communities don't come to the studies because there is bias. They don't feel safe in this environment. And I think it's important to repair the mistakes of the past and to let them feel included in our studies, because if not, we're not going to get them in our study. So especially in our lab is placed in a psychiatric institution. Just 30 years before, 30, 50 years before, those people were not feeling really safe in this environment. So I think it's important to really put a focus more on these groups to get them in our study if we want to have a more proportionate sample even, yeah.
And what you mentioned, I mean, there is definitely a bias in data because usually research is done on male, female, man, woman, yeah, but not on gender diverse individuals.
When you put a poster for all the population, a study where you include everybody, you don't really get everybody. You get those people who feel safe to come to your lab.
And I mean, also, if you go back a little bit further and look at a lot of medical studies, most of them were only done on men. So that's also
big problem.
Yeah. We have to put restrictions to include women. So, yeah.
Women are not just small men.
Yeah.
Since we started off as a cognitive science podcast, what role does cognition play in your research? We talked quite a lot about cognition, but what role does it actually play?
I think cognition is really at the interface of what is health and well-being. You know, it's not clearly just the brain. It's clearly also influenced by the body. So I think cognition is kind of a good bellwether of the individual's state of healthiness and well-being. That's how I situate cognition is mm-hmm. sort of the bridge between the body and the brain.
Yeah, I think it's really true what you said. And as I am doing my classes to become a neuropsychologist, that's how we describe it to clients sometimes. When we look at cognition, we want to understand it's the link between your anatomy, your brain, how is it work, and your comportments, how do you work in your everyday life. And so it's really central for me, cognition, because it's my research, but it's also my clinical program. And everything that we talked about today will influence clinical population directly. So we talk a lot about sex differences, gender differences in cognition. And as a neuropsychologist, and when we test people, we want to know how their cognition is working. We have a lot of gender norms for a lot of that cognitive tasks. So if we have a client that is a woman, then you will take the test and put it in women norms. But what do we do with trans people, with non-binary people? We don't have norms for those populations. So maybe we make a lot of mistakes and also have norms that are so binary. Does it really represent what is really going on? I don't think so. So everything I think research in my clinical program really links around cognition.
Yeah. And then lastly, I would ask both of you to maybe summarize in one or two sentences what people who have listened to this whole episode should definitely remember.
I would say that sex alone as a binary is not enough to explain cognition, well-being, and health, and that one should not shy away from the complexity. On the contrary, the more variables you add and nuance and break apart, the more interesting it becomes. And the whole reason that we do this work is to understand individual differences. And in doing that, we recognize that it really is this incredible constellation of variation. And that's the only constant, is that we're always going to see variation. And I think that's a really good thing. You know, scientists should not always be thinking that, oh, I'm going to have my homogeneous little group. It's not realistic. And I think related to that, you know, being not afraid to do work that verges on objective subjective. You know, I think a lot of people can confront this kind of work and say, oh, well, you know, you're a person of the community or you're not. You know, does that influence the work that you do? I think science is becoming a lot more interested in positionality. So people being able to say, this is what I bring to the table and this is my lived experience. But also recognizing that will influence how you react to the research. And I think doing this kind of work alone is not possible. So that's why we're privileged to work with wonderful students like Nina and with great teams in order to do this kind of work. And to be, like Nina said, a safe space, not just for our participants, but for our team.
Yeah, that was perfectly said. I don't think I have anything to add.
So with that being said, I think also Sophie's name, I can just say thank you so much for your time. And
yeah, my pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Great. Auf Wiedersehen.
You've listened to Collider Science, Conversations on Cognitive Science, hosted by Elisa Palmer, Sönke Löw and Sophie Kühne. Produced by Clara Kühne, Imogen Hüsing, Elisa Palmer, Sönke Löw and Sophie Kühne. Produced in collaboration with the Cognitive Science Student Journal. The music was produced by Jan-Lukas Schröder. The logo was designed by Annika Richter. Thank you for listening and joining us on our journey through Conversations on Cognitive Science. This podcast is not sponsored and does not give us any financial profit. If you wish to support us, the most effective way is to do so by leaving us an up to 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and following us on Instagram. You can reach out to us via mail, comment on YouTube, or message us on Instagram. We are always happy to hear your feedback. Thank you again for listening to us and for your interest in science. If you have any questions regarding this episode or any of our other episodes, feel free to reach out. You can reach out to us via Instagram by sending us a direct message at kaleidoscience_pod or write us an email at kaleidopod@us.de. You can find both links to our Instagram and also the email address in our show notes. We do read all your comments and will also reply to you as soon as we can.